Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Thank you all very much for coming. I'm Georgina Godwin. This event is brought to you by the Writers' Centre in Norwich in Britain. It's part of the National Conversation, which explores hard-hitting questions about the ways in which we produce and engage with writing and how we treat writers. I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about the Writers' Centre Norwich, which works with writers, obviously, literary translators, readers, publishers, agents, booksellers, and many more in the literary ecology. Well, like everyone, the Centre's been witness to the many changes taking place in our world over recent years. Digital technologies, transforming publishing opportunities, challenges to the retail book trade, the struggle to fund libraries, and the rise of creative writing programs are just a few of the many tectonic shifts happening in our world. Well, we're having a series of 14 events across Britain and beyond over a two-year period, and we're so pleased to be able to bring it here to Cartagena. It's really, really exciting that this conversation is taking place here and not in London or New York. It seems the absolutely ideal venue to explore ideas around the shift in power within publishing from the Northern Hemisphere. So, south to south, is the metropolis still the place to publish? That's the question which our panelists will be debating. And I'd like to introduce you to them, but now, joining us on Skype from Kenya, we hope, of course, there are many digital challenges between us blithely saying that and actually achieving it, is Binyavanga Wainana. Now, he is a writer, he's the editor of the literary magazine Kwani, and he was named by Time magazine as one of the world's most influential 100 people. Claudia Lopez de la Madrid is the editor with Penguin Random House in Barcelona. Of course, they are the biggest Spanish language publishing group in the world. Next to him on the other side, Ella Wakatama Allfree, an independent editor. She's also a board member of the Writers' Centre Norwich and one of the judges for this year's Man Booker Prize. And finally, Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, if you've been to any of the events here over the last few days, Oscar's almost ubiquitous, probably the hardest working writer here at the festival. He's the London-based award-winning Colombian writer and philosopher. He lectures on philosophy and law at Birkbeck College at University of London. So we're going to start with a presentation from Binyavanga, and this he recorded for us earlier, so any of those technical bugbears that we hope we're not going to be finding later on have been ironed out in this instance, because this is what Binyavanga had to say.
Hello everybody, I hope you're enjoying yourselves in Colombia, and the festival is wonderful. I'm sorry I couldn't make it. I'm supposed to talk about the upending of publishing and digital networks. Several years ago, we'd started a publishing house called Kwani. And at the time, a young group of writers had kind of agreed that we'd try and not sell African rights to our work to Western publishers, so that we would say, oh, I want a deal. This had happened because Helon Habila at the time had his book published by Penguin, and that they kept the Commonwealth rights but were unable to distribute the book in Nigeria because they don't. And, you know, so these were conversations that we were having all the time at conferences that we met and so on and so forth. So when I sold my book to Granter, I said, I want to keep my African rights because we've got an independent publishing house here which can publish, distribute. We sell books up to 1,000 copies, print runs up to 1,000, even up to 3,000. There was Farafina in Nigeria, there was Chimurenga and other independent publishers in South Africa. We were in a season of independent publishing. Granter said, no, there's no way. Let's just tell you something. There is no way that you will ever be allowed to disbundle what they call Commonwealth rights, and say, I want to pick which part of the Commonwealth I want my rights in. If there's one colonial advantage British-based publishers have, it is that you can't do that, or you're not allowed to do that, or they'll make it very expensive for you to do that. This means, very simply, for example, if an Indian bookstore, chain of bookstores, wants to import a version of an important book by an Indian, and so goes to South Africa, which is in the Commonwealth of English, to buy cheap copies, they'll be told, no, you have to order them from the UK. So the price of books in English, in India, in English-speaking Africa, is insane. So you're paying for the print runs that are made in the United Kingdom, for United Kingdom audiences. There are 1 billion Indians. There are close to 200 million Nigerians, 30 million Kenyans. There could be 200 million Africans who are educated and whose official language is English. So there we sit. Now, I was recently in a conversation. We are starting a publishing house, a digital publishing house. We want to produce mass-based books digitally. Romance, sci-fi, so we have this team of people who are trying to create large numbers and diversity of books to distribute. And so I met this guy who had done these sorts of research on where digital education is going to go in the developing world and so on and so forth. And he said, there are 100,000 innovative ideas on how to transform education in the developing world. But our ideas that we thought about, our consultancy with all the money that we had, and it had a lot of money to do that research, not much could make a difference because the textbook publishers live in another era, which is to say they will not cede ground in any form, and they are in command of what our kids learn in school. Their rights system, the way those rights systems have evolved from the colonial time, are, to put it mildly, hectic, crazy, colonial, controlling, and so on and so forth. Now, for me, the question is, the beginning to bypass starts to happen that it's where mass-based, fresh, original, relevant, interesting content, and in my world, fiction, popular fiction, romance, sci-fi, futurism, erotica, fun children's books that are relevant to really probably the largest and most complex society in the world that is fortunate in some form had never fallen yet into a certain way the mafias of both publishing, producing, production of knowledge had. It's not by will, it's by chance. Africa was maybe not a good investment destination, and so these networks did not establish themselves firmly. So what we have right now is 130 million people, I'm told, by McKinsey, who consume between $4 and $20 a day. That number will double in 8 years to close to 300 million people. And those 300 million people have money to consume, have smartphones, and don't need to buy books. And so to buy a book, really, if you put it very simply, is to buy into an ownership system of which the $14 you African will pay for that book, right? There's $9 going to some other publisher, there's $1.50 going to some writer, Chimamanda Adichie Binyavanga Wainaina, who, at least me, have not built a house with the money I have earned of writing. And then other middle networks, because all these publishing companies own each other, and the other one owns the other one, and the other one owns the other one. This shit has been dating back to I don't know when. But those things are frozen. They're frozen. Of course, we're in the season of the great opening. They're frozen, but they have not penetrated. Which is to say, to buy a new Penguin book in Africa, you would have to go on a hunt so complex, so diabolical, so expensive, so impossible to find a relevant book for you. You won't find one. You'll find three. And maybe one every 3 years turns up. And it's half your salary to buy it. It's not a sustainable model. So, of course, we could say we're going to have a revolution and bear arms and destroy the whole thing, or hire Hackers Anonymous to just kill all their archives, but that kind of would be a waste of time. Because quite simply, if you produce mass books now, I mean, if you simply get money, investment money, put your own money down, and produce 40, 50, 60, 100, 200 books a year, right now you have platforms that are thirsty for content, thirsty, and there is no content being made. Because no one's been stupid enough to say, I'll put my money down and make this content, and this content is essential. Not essential necessarily for social good, So it is essential for social good, but essential because people like to imagine. Essential because, let me start here. So now you have, let's look at this thing called Nigeria. 200 million people, it's the largest black African country. They say its population will exceed the India's in 2050. Place of enormous talents, enormous diversity, many, many old kingdoms. Some are have populations that have a population now, like the Yoruba have, over 20 million people. There are 20 million Hausas. There are 20 million Igbos. Lagos is population 19 million, depending on who's doing the talking. So now, so this bunch of people, right, the people who distribute goods in that place are nobody's bookshop or nobody's film service supply enterprise to give you Hollywood films. No, it's Igbo market traders, or let's call them market traders in Lagos, Onitsha. These cities, they're cities that are markets. Onitsha, Aba. And what people have been doing in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, there was a thing called Onitsha market literature. It's popular literature written, produced, and distributed by market traders in Nigeria. We're in that season again. So then comes Nollywood. What is Nollywood? Not even 10 years have passed between before this thing properly explodes into the world, right? People with cheap cameras, not even digital yet, making movies in a week. Hundreds and hundreds of movies, and throwing them down this pipeline of rivers, roads, trains, ideas, bicycles, all over Nigeria, yes? Primarily in Pidgin English or in English, in Yoruba, now there's Yoruba one, yeah? And from the day it started, people bought. They bought. Then they bought again, and bought. And bought. The thing has multiplied so many times, no one even knows. They say it's the second largest film industry in the world. No one knows, because there's just more keeps coming. Now, Nollywood films right now are on digital networks, which is to say, on the service middle class pay TV channels, the dedicated channels to just Yoruba films, the dedicated channels to just Rivers films in less than 10 years. You have an industry paying. Not owned by anybody, not Apple, no big corporate, no one can buy in, because they can't even get in the tangle of networks, relationships, whatever. It's like, as a decolonizing act, there's nothing, you can't get better than Nollywood. Like, you can put your copyright law and do whatever you want to do, but copyright to protect what? Someone is making relevant content. Relevant just for the cheap thrills that it produces. Relevant for the idea that it just was Africans kissing Africans, talking to Africans, marrying Africans, diabolically manipulating other Africans in diabolically melodramatic thrillers. I got hooked. Me with all my highfalutin, read Proust and whatever, I keep watching them. This woman who converts people into a cell phone. How better can you get than that? So my contention really is first that the writers of my generation and the writers in English, certainly out of Africa, generally are products of a publishing industry, right? They may be people who loved to read. They may be people who were the only person among, or one of 100 people in their primary school, and their primary school was an elite primary school of, bright young Anglo-educated or Anglo-facing Africans who learned to know what a penguin book looks like and what good prose looks like in English and so on and so forth, and with constantly the eye out there and at some idea that you can contend, and I believe I can, with those cool writers in New York and those cool writers in London for the same edge of a marketplace, which is like you're edgy or different or cool or socially concerned or more socially concerned or even more socially concerned than anything else. But really, the majority of your cash money comes because of the people in the Midwest. That's who it is. It's George and Dave Matilda in the Midwest who are the buyers. That's the primary place that all English-speaking publishing faces ultimately, and when it's doing so in fiction. Right? That's why people get book deals, they get contracts and everything else. That even those novels may end up being on a reading list in an education system in Africa is only a byproduct of the fact of it had been bought for the Midwest. Now, So my question really is, who is avant-garde? And by avant-garde, who is the person who is creating the revolution? And the revolution really is the necessity for books. The necessity for books at this point just means something bound, pounded, and cheaply available to a mass audience. And because we are not binding anymore, because you don't have to bind, you don't have to build bookstores, you don't have to transport books up and down the middle of nowhere, it's going to be a digital revolution. It's going to be a digital revolution simply because it can be. Simply because the platforms are there to buy, sell, distribute, download in minutes, this thing. In my country, we have digital money, and so I pay my bills with my phone. I don't, no cash transaction. You can buy my book for about $2 on the phone and download it. Now, my book, which I love producing it, is never going to be a mass book. For reasons we can talk about for hours and hours and hours, but there'll be a waste of time now. What my book can do is not save African literature. It has its own esoteric audience, and it'll continue to. It won't pay my rent. It'll pay nobody's rent. It'll build new industries. None of these books are going to build industries. Chimamanda's books are not going to build industries. So to build industries is having thousands and thousands of romance books, of kids' fantasy books, of transporting our children away, getting them hooked on these things through this just sheer transportation. At this point, the medium of transportation is not that important, which is to say, is it a spaceship? Is it using African technology? Do I care? Is it Africans? Yes. Is Africans speaking an African language? Is it Africans who look like the kids you have in school? Is it, those are the now primal questions that we have. Like, you want that initial spurt, which really needs money, you know, really investment money to not just pay writers decently, pay writers something, and to be able to purchase the time to get talent to produce large amounts of work and sell them. That's what I've been involved with. That's why I came back from America, because I found America boring. It's not a wonderful place. It's diverse. I live just outside New York City. I was there a long time. It was wonderful. But I was too old to enter that little thing called the melting pot and melt. I was unmelted, and it's not yet meltable. I think you have to do that when you're like 16 to melt, to be meltable. I'm not meltable. Further to that, people say New York City is diverse, which is something I understand and don't understand. So it's like a menu, you know? So like, oh, like today I can have Haitian sex, you know, with vegan, Swedish burgers, and so on and so forth. And you have all these diverse communities. But, you know, what is a common platform? I mean, people are existing in a common platform. It's a common schooling system. So it's just very bright colors, a few publishing houses, and so on and so forth. But those bright colors talk about diversity. But here, what we're talking about is that the platforms within which people live, what people call community, can be 20 million people, can be 200 people. Their manner of engagement, their manner of politics and everything else, all these are things still in formation. There is no agreed platform yet. And because there's no agreed platform yet, there's not only one to do, there are adventures to be had in terms of creating. And so the making of the platforms now is interesting, because it's now not making of a digital platform. The digital platforms are there in their hundreds. Easy ones to make, easy ones to monetize, and so on and so forth, is that to throw the diversity of stories into these platforms and sell them. It's not in our question of thinking too much. And because we've seen not only the Nollywood industry, we've seen the Nollywood industry grow, explode. Kenya has now river making films. Ghana has a film industry. Exploded, right? Cheap cameras. We've seen now the Nigerian pop music industry explode. And it came in much later than the film industry and is diverse, complicated. But what's interesting is it's taken the same types of people. There's people from the same networks that produce the writers, which is to say, the middle classes with their overt Christianity quite often, with their addiction to Western books and so on and so forth. And they've learned themselves how to find ways to be more diverse Nigerians. So you've got middle class kids learning pidgin so they can sing songs that hundreds of millions of people can consume. You have rappers who are all of 21 years old, you're rapping in Yoruba, and because there are 20 million Yoruba people, they're a marketplace. And now, where are they? That person can get the limelight on the digital pay TV networks 10 times more than any Chimamanda or any other person, simply because they can, simply because they have that mass audience, simply because they produced for it. They didn't, it's not even asking what does the audience want, right? At some point, it was just really, why doesn't anybody sing songs in Yoruba that are relevant to my life? And so just the fact of somebody singing it becomes a revolutionary act. The fact of somebody ennobling Pidgin becomes a revolutionary act because you transact in Pidgin, you live in Pidgin. Millions, tens of millions of you. And nobody, really, see, hardly anybody, even me, genuinely, lives in the language of the prose venue which I produce. So my proposition basically is that in terms of saving these platforms that maybe can carry some literature, maybe we'll send 10,000 copies. I think there are novelists, literary novelists in Nigeria who will send 30,000 copies in 10 years and something like this. That's true. But that's not the creation of a marketplace. I'm very, very interested personally in being that generation of people who own the wealth of our content. Really genuinely own it. And genuinely speak to those Africans and other people around the world with real money and say, this giant hole has to be plugged. At this point, those platforms have been made. They can digest enormous amounts of content. My phone can digest as many novels as I want. And that we are in this kind of ridiculous, complaining position of saying that there are no novels. Like, how come that gap is not being made where the $3 or $4 million that's just needed to start to kickstart an industry that produces hundreds and hundreds of novels, just so I have enough for my phone. My phone! So may I'm not part of this sentimental, nostalgic, where did literature go, book loving, the smell of books, Proust nonsense. I want to be part of the new world. An African, we are the new world.
Thank you very much to Binyavanga. I'm not sure how clear the audio was at the back. Just briefly to summarize, he was obviously focusing on the colonial legacy of rights ownership that controls the marketplace to the benefit of the London, New York few rather than the global many. It was a call to reject the traditions of literature, the publishing houses who guard the content, and also to say that it's time really to embrace digital mediums of content provision so that African literature, and of course literature from across the rest of the world, can reflect and interact with the societies in which it's written. To address that, I think we'll turn first to our first panelist here, who is Claudio Lopez de la Madrid. He'll be speaking in Spanish, so those non-Spanish speakers may want to put on your headphones now.
Buenos días. Me pareció muy interesante el vídeo y toca algunos puntos. Claro, yo desconozco por completo la realidad africana, aparte de publicar a un par de autores del continente.
It's okay, we're just sorting out this one here. Sorry to interrupt you. If you give that to Ella, please.
Desconozco la realidad africana, pero sí noto que hay algunas coincidencias con lo que podría ser la relación. ¿No se oye? Noto que hay algunas coincidencias, no muchas, pues son menos de las que yo me creía, con la relación que hay en sistema de publicación entre Europa, o en este caso España, y Latinoamérica. He notado en el vídeo bastantes críticas a lo que se ha llamado la mafia editorial, a la idea de que los grandes grupos editoriales, ha hablado mucho de Penguin, que es el grupo para el que yo trabajo, retienen los derechos de la propiedad intelectual de los libros que compran y no dejan que se expresen en los países africanos, por ejemplo. Y creo que un poco, para quienes no la conozcáis, para ti, tú, Óscar, la conoces mucho mejor, la realidad española, la realidad de la lengua española, la realidad de la publicación en lengua española es ligeramente distinta. De un tiempo a esta parte las cosas están cambiando, pero hasta hace poco muchos agentes, sobre todo los agentes literarios más importantes, tenían la tendencia a dividir el mercado, ¿no? Había una industria editorial muy potente en España, pero también había una industria editorial muy potente en América Latina y que sobre todo había sido en un momento determinado mucho más potente y pujante que la española, y me refiero durante todo los años del franquismo. Durante los años del franquismo, durante los años de la dictadura de Franco en España, con la censura, los dos focos de edición en lengua española eran por un lado México y por otro lado Argentina. Nosotros, los de mi generación, la generación de Óscar, hemos crecido, yo en España, en Colombia, hemos crecido leyendo traducciones argentinas de todos los libros de Kafka, de Germán Gess, del Ulises de Joyce. Todos estos libros hemos leído en traducciones argentinas. Eso, cuando se acabó el franquismo y se restableció la democracia en España, se normalizó, y la industria, también por una cuestión de primer mundo, de poder económico, pasó a sentarse fundamentalmente en España. Y realmente lo pasó de forma muy rápida y se estableció en España, y realmente la industria, como si dijéramos, latinoamericana, se desarticuló muy rápido también, ¿no? Un cambio, la subida de uno significó la bajada muy rápida de otro. Las editoriales que estaban establecidas en Argentina, Fabril, MC, etcétera, fueron absorbidas por grupos españoles o cerraron. Grijalbo en México volvió cuando se acabó la Franco a España, se situaron allá, y entonces se cambió muy rápido. Eso es algo que ha sido así durante 15 años. Yo creo que las cosas han cambiado, y en estos momentos con la crisis en Europa y en España es muy 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 punzante. De dos o tres años a esta parte, todo el mundo ha adquirido la conciencia de que no el futuro de la industria del libro, que el futuro de la industria del libro no es que pase por Latinoamérica, es que el presente de la industria del libro solo existe en función solo existe gracias fundamentalmente a Latinoamérica. Yo digo, trabajo en un grupo que posiblemente en lengua española sea el grupo más grande de todos, y es un grupo que yo he comprobado, llevo 10 años trabajando aquí, he comprobado cómo la facturación en España era así, la facturación en Latinoamérica era así, he comprobado cómo se va acercando, y nosotros sabemos ya hoy en día, a medida que los países americanos se van incorporando, van mejorando su economía, estamos convencidos de que dentro de nada ya será los beneficios de que sacaremos en América Latina, que sacará la industria de América Latina, será mucho mayores. Eso implica toda una serie de cambios que afectan a la forma un poco de entender el negocio, ¿no? Ahora cada vez más se hacen los libros aquí, cada vez más se traducen aquí, etcétera, etcétera. Bueno, yo creo que me gustaría seguir hablando, pero creo que hablaré después de... Lo he hecho simplemente para...
You will. You will get to speak a lot more later, I hope. Thank you very much to Claudio. If we could get a response now from Ella.
I'm very happy to have Claudio responding as a publisher, and I have to confess that that publishing mafia he was talking about, I started my first job at Penguin and my second at Random House, so I was brought up by the mafia and am now sort of working independently. I had the great good fortune to be the editor of a publication that the Hay Festivals put together called Africa 39, published last year, in which 39 African writers under the age of 40 were showcased to the world. This was an interesting experience because the writers were writing love stories, they were writing crime fiction, fantasy. It wasn't a genre publication, there were lots of literary stories within that. But very many of the genres that Binyavanga was talking about were exhibited. Which was more important was that these writers were post-colonial writers, I guess we would talk about. These were writers who were children or born after independence in the various African countries they represented. So their concerns were not about the colonies, were not about the Northern Hemisphere in the stories that we saw. They were concerned about many times the failures of the generation of post-independence leaders, and also about hope for the future. I mention this because even while I support Binyavanga's call for the revolution, and even though I acknowledge that the digital media gives us a good future, I think everyone knows that a revolution starts off with lofty ideas, but very soon you have to get to the hard work of what you're wanting to do, the hard work of the creation of that marketplace. And for that, you need editors. You need proofreaders. You need people who actually take the content and make it into a book, because it's not just about the creation of the content. None of the African countries I work in face the problem of not having good writers. We have, and have always had, excellent writers and excellent storytellers. What is not there is the industry to support them. And I was very interested to hear Claudio's saying, I think, really, that many Latin American countries don't face that same problem. Which brings us to the whole idea of the South-to-South dialogue. Is there room, indeed, for publishing industries to work together if there's such a disparity in the stage of evolution for the industries? But I think I maybe would just like to close and say that as publishers and as people concerned with literature, we have a lot to learn from ourselves as readers, but basically the people who are reading the books. If you take a Colombian writer, a Mexican writer, and give them to a reader in an African country, there's a recognition there of a human condition that's being spoken about. There's a dialogue that needs no mitigation by New York or London. And I think that if we take this at the heart of whatever revolution we're talking about, the idea that a reader can imagine themselves in a different place and put in the hard work to create the industries, to create the people who actually produce the book once the writer has done their work, then we may be some way towards success. If not, then maybe the mafia will just continue to reign. Thank you.
Thank you to Ella. We'll move on now to Oscar, please.
If you don't mind, I would prefer to speak in Spanish. Quizás me encuentro en una posición singular, en la medida en que soy un escritor colombiano, pero que suele escribir en inglés y cuyos centros de publicación y lectura están en Nueva York, en Londres y en Delhi, en la India. Es donde me muevo con mayor frecuencia. Y quizás en razón de ello querría hacer dos observaciones. La primera es que sería muy importante tomarse en serio no solo el llamado, sino la distinción muy interesante que hizo Vindhyavanga Wainaina entre lo que él llamó una mafia de las publicaciones, la industria de las publicaciones, y lo que como filósofo me parece muchísimo más peligroso, también en el caso latinoamericano, que es la mafia de la producción de conocimiento. Y esto me lleva a la segunda observación. Nosotros los latinoamericanos nos independizamos de España hace 210 años. Pero esa independencia política no fue seguida, no del todo, no lo suficiente, de independencia intelectual. A nosotros nos siguen pensando desde España. Fue muy interesante escuchar a Carlos decir, y es correcto, que el balance de facturación en la industria editorial entre España y Latinoamérica está cambiando por razones económicas. Razones que además no se conocen muy bien en América Latina, porque en América Latina, especialmente en Colombia, se reporta muy mal lo que ha estado ocurriendo en Europa durante esta última década y media. Yo le hablo a mis amigos colombianos, y no estoy hablando, digamos, de, y no cualesquiera amigos, políticos, periodistas, los intelectuales, entre comillas, más preclaros del país, acerca de lo que he visto, que llevo mucho tiempo viajando por Grecia, por Italia, por España, y es como si les estuviese hablando de otro planeta. ¿Cuál es la razón de ello? De una parte, que no se reporta bien lo que ocurre allí. De la otra, que no lo queremos ver. El problema de la descolonización intelectual tiene que ver con que no podemos seguir culpando a Occidente, no podemos seguir culpando a España porque ellos nos piensen a nosotros. El problema es que nosotros no nos estamos pensando a nosotros mismos. Si ustedes observan la novelística actual en Latinoamérica, que está en un momento muy, muy interesante, la actual, la de mis amigos, la de mi generación, ustedes encuentran una literatura rica en términos de su artesanía y su manejo de los lenguajes. Pero cuando le pedimos a esa literatura que responda preguntas de primer orden, preguntas metafísicas, preguntas tan concretas y tan importantes para la realidad latinoamericana como la cuestión del poder, hay muy poco de eso. Hay muy poco de lo que se trataba en literatura, tanto en ficción como en no ficción, en los años que Carlos describía, esos años de explosión de editoriales y de creatividad literaria en América Latina, básicamente en los 60s y 70s. Eso se fue junto con las editoriales y no ha regresado. No ha regresado. Si usted es un filósofo, tiene que tratar de publicar por España. Eso ya es muy difícil, porque el supuesto es que los filósofos no venden. El supuesto es que ese tipo de literatura no tiene público. A lo que, por supuesto, uno tiene que oponer los ejemplos más obvios. Desde el intelectual esloveno, ojo, es uno que viene de la periferia europea, Slavoj Žižek, mi colega en la Universidad de Londres, que vende como pan caliente, hasta el tipo de ejercicio que traté de hacer con mi último libro publicado en Gran Bretaña, un libro sobre el Chile de Allende, sobre esa década, que llegó, alguien diría para sorpresa de muchos, a la lista de bestsellers publicada por el Guardian, uno de los periódicos más importantes de Londres. Yo me pregunto por qué ese tipo de fenómeno está ausente en nuestro momento literario en América Latina. Así que yo quisiera poner el énfasis, no solo y no tanto en la llamada mafia editorial, entre otras cosas porque yo no le voy a pedir a la industria editorial que haga algo diferente de lo que tiene que hacer. Es una industria, opera bajo principios ganancia y pérdida. No le voy a pedir que se dedique a hacer obras de caridad intelectual. Me preocupa más el tema de la mafia de producción de conocimiento. Nosotros los latinoamericanos, en particular los colombianos, que nos estamos acercando a un momento político sumamente importante, carecemos de los intelectuales y del lenguaje público más refinado, conceptualmente más rico, que nos permita pensar cómo va a ser esa Colombia después del conflicto. Y eso entonces debería prender todas nuestras alarmas. Y la razón de ello es que no carecemos de esos intelectuales. En Colombia hay pensadores de la talla de un Santiago Castro Gómez, pero permítame preguntar, ¿cuántos de ustedes lo han leído? Alcen la mano. ¿Lo ven? Y eso no se va a resolver con medios digitales. Todas las obras de Santiago están disponibles en la red, pero ustedes no las conocen porque, como bien decía Ella, lo que está ausente es la relación con el editor, lo que está ausente es la relación con las oficinas de marketing de las editoriales, que puedan también asumir que en países como los latinoamericanos existe la necesidad de pensarse a sí mismos. Entonces, Carlos, lo que te voy a pedir es que nos ayudes a desmantelar esa muy peculiar, todavía muy colonial división del trabajo, de acuerdo con la cual los latinoamericanos podemos producir cultura, es decir, somos muy buenos para bailar, somos muy buenos para escribir novelas exóticas, bien sea realista mágicas o realista trágicas. Y quizás, dicen los señores de acá, seremos muy buenos en hacer el amor, yo no lo sé, pero se supone que no podemos producir teoría. No hacemos teoría. Desmantelemos esa división del trabajo que persiste. Y por supuesto que la responsabilidad de hacerlo es nuestra, es de los latinoamericanos, no es de los europeos. Y entonces sí podremos hablar de la revolución a la que correctamente llama a Viñabanga Wainaina.
Thank you. Thank you. Claudio, I can see that you were longing to jump in there. So
yo no estoy de acuerdo con lo que dices, pero fundamentalmente porque yo soy muy negativo con la situación actual en Europa, en España en concreto y en Europa en particular. Mi grupo es un grupo, para el grupo de trabajo es transnacional y la verdad que su vocación es fundamentalmente, yo creo que es más, tiene una vocación más latinoamericana que europeísta o que española. Nosotros tenemos presencia en 7 países. En cada uno de esos países hay un equipo editorial importante, pues estoy hablando, por ejemplo, en México pueden haber 80 personas y en Argentina pueden haber 70 y en Colombia hay, son 32 personas trabajando, cuyo trabajo no es reproducir lo que se hace en España, sino más bien todo lo contrario, sino es hacer un programa editorial, que es un programa editorial fundamentalmente local. Yo te lo podría decir país por país, pero si quieres te lo digo respecto a Colombia. El programa editorial que hace Penguin Random House en Colombia es en un 65% libros local, de contratación local, libros que se contratan localmente. Mientras que el resto de los libros sí que son libros que o vienen de España, o vienen de Argentina, o vienen de parte del grupo. Eso es algo que sucede en todos los países. Yo, mi gran lucha en estos momentos, sí que es cierto también que todo escritor latinoamericano sigue teniendo el sueño de España. Considera que si no es publicado en España es un autor de segunda línea, cuando lo que no saben es que la mayoría, yo intento explicarles que publicar hoy en día en España es casi como no publicar, porque realmente las ventas son inexistentes y el interés que hay, ¿entiendes?, por todo lo que sea, no latinoamericano, sino cultural en general, es bajísimo. Yo intento convencer, y yo, por ejemplo, me entusiasmo cuando un autor mío como Santiago Gamboa, que vivía en Roma hasta este año, se ha trasladado a vivir a Cali, porque para mí, yo creo que, pero yo eso lo decía ayer, es que para tu carrera es lo mejor que puedes hacer, es mucho mejor estar en Cali, porque estás cerca de Perú, de México, estás al tiro de piedra, de Bogotá, de Medellín, puedes viajar a Chile desde aquí, estás centrado, hoy en día yo creo que el centro, por ejemplo, de la industria cultural, de la industria editorial está en América Latina. Intento convencer a todos mis autores que lo hagan. Que no pretendan triunfar en España, porque no van a triunfar, porque en España no es que no triunfen ellos, es que no triunfa nadie, no triunfan ni los españoles. Y al mismo tiempo es el mismo mensaje que estoy lanzando a todos los autores míos españoles, como Javier Cercas, que tú bien conoces, o Julio Navarro. Son, les digo, si vosotros, el futuro, el presente y el futuro de la industria editorial, el futuro de la venta, el entusiasmo y la evolución que hay en América Latina, no está en España ni va a volver a estar nunca en España. Lo que tenéis que hacer vosotros es viajar y daros a conocer en América y trabajar y ahí. Y todos vienen y todos están entusiasmados. Pregunta a cualquiera de los autores españoles que veas por aquí cuál es la sensación que ellos tienen de su trabajo en España y cuál es la sensación que tienen en América Latina. Yo soy mucho más optimista con lo que está sucediendo aquí. Creo que los autores tienen posibilidades de salida y, sin embargo, soy muy pesimista con lo que sucede en España.
Thank you very much. I'd like to widen this out slightly and bring in an African perspective and just reference back to what Binyavanga was talking about. Ella, if I could ask you about the commercial and cultural benefit of south-to-south dialogue.
I think I touched on it a little bit in my first response, where I was saying that the readers, when readers are faced with books, I spoke to a wonderful young lady earlier who was very disappointed that Binyavanga wasn't here because she had read his book and absolutely connected with it. And I think that sometimes as editors sitting in an office in London or New York, the idea of selling those rights or translating those books is a secondary idea, because unlike the publishing in Spain where Claudio says nothing happens, for an African writer, being published in London is a big deal because it's thought that that's the only place where things can happen. But then the selling on of those rights to countries that are in the Southern Hemisphere is a secondary consideration. But every time you meet readers, they are responding to those works. I have to say, at this point, the benefit is only cultural. There's a connection, and Binyavanga spoke a lot about Yoruba, and there is, you know, there are influences, African cultural influences within Latin American countries. So I think that that's where the benefit is. I'm afraid at this point I can't actually see that there is any commercial benefit for a publisher for that thing. I just want to respond a little bit to what Oscar was saying, and while I understand and quite relish that challenge of an engagement with those first order questions. I wonder if we shouldn't also be thinking about education, because as publishers, we're producing books to be read. People will buy those books, we make our money, we pay our salaries. But unless the population is educated to want to read, to want to think about those questions, you're not building that marketplace. And I think that that's one of the really important questions about this dialogue, is how are populations being educated to be concerned about themselves, but also concerned about each other? And that was very interesting, the fact, Oscar, that you said to Claudio that there needs to be help from, you know, the Spanish language publishing houses based in Spain. I actually disagree. There doesn't need to be any help, because we know where the power lies and we know where we want it to lie. So just as gold and coltan and people have been exported from African countries, so now our creativity is being exported as well. And to own that creativity in the way that Binyavanga suggests means that we have to ignore those centers of power and to shift our gaze to our own places. And that doesn't involve asking for any kind of help or for permission. It involves doing the hard work ourselves.
Es que me encanta la oportunidad de hablar en español. Dos observaciones. Tienes absoluta razón, Ella, al decir que así como se están exportando nuestro oro y nuestros minerales, es decir, que Eduardo Galeano sigue vigente, así duélale a quien le duela, también se exporta nuestra creatividad. Mi petición de ayuda no iba tanto en el sentido de que son los centros de poder los que deben hacer el ejercicio. También argumenté que, de una parte, debemos dejar de culpar a los centros de poder por lo que ha sido una negligencia de nuestra parte, y por lo mismo somos nosotros quienes tendremos que hacer el esfuerzo. La petición de ayuda va en un sentido muy concreto. Claudio va a ir y le va a preguntar a su equipo editorial, después de esta sesión, a su equipo editorial aquí en Colombia, ustedes por qué nunca me habían hablado de Santiago Castro Gómez. Él va a hacer eso. Y estoy dando, por supuesto, solo un ejemplo. Pero es que este es un exquisito escritor que se lee muchísimo, que además participa en el proceso educativo, porque si bien es cierto que necesitas una masa de lectores educados para poder producir libros que traten cuestiones de primer orden, pues por supuesto eso es una relación circular. Si produces ese tipo de libros y los llevas, la gente va a querer leerlos. Y la razón por la cual soy un optimista, ustedes me conocen bien y saben que solamente creo en el optimismo, creo que los pesimistas son malos mentirosos, no realistas, como dicen. Me encanta ir al Hey Jalapa, a la Feria de Guadalajara, a la Feria del Libro en Bogotá, o este festival. Y uno ve cuánta gente pasa por estos festivales y la enorme sed de conocimiento que existe. Nos siguen diciendo que, por supuesto, las ratios de lectura de lectores en un país como Colombia versus libros son muy bajas. Parte de la razón es que no estamos haciendo el esfuerzo de llevar los libros a donde tenemos que llevarlos. Nuestras editoriales no pueden dedicarse solamente a poner sus libros en las editoriales que en Bogotá todas están, en las tiendas de libros que están ubicadas todas de la avenida Primero de Mayo hacia el norte. Porque te estás perdiendo a más de la mitad de la ciudad. Esto para no hablar de eso que llaman aquí, dizque la otra Colombia, que es la toda Colombia. De nuevo, el esfuerzo que tenemos que hacer en el posconflicto es precisamente el de llegar hasta allá. Y le puedo pedir la ayuda a Claudio, porque como Claudio dice correctamente, el centro, esa relación, ahí sí ya no es relevante Eduardo Galeano, esa relación de centros a periferias ha cambiado. En muchas ocasiones se ha invertido, como en el caso España-Latinoamérica. En otras ocasiones simplemente no hay diferencias entre los centros y las periferias. Precisamente porque ellos saben muy bien que el futuro y el presente de la industria editorial en español está en América Latina, es que podemos darnos el lujo de pedirle a Claudio que no solamente les pregunte, sino que los regañe así con mirada firme. ¿Y ustedes por qué no me habían hablado de esto? Porque ahí, en ese momento, nosotros de este escritor de Santiago, porque en ese momento sus grupos editoriales van a empezar a cuestionarse sus propios prejuicios acerca de lo que funciona o no funciona como literatura en América Latina, y eso incluye empezar a ver otros mercados. Las relaciones sur-sur, como saben ustedes muy bien, han cambiado por completo la geopolítica de las Américas. No es solo una cuestión de Latinoamérica y Europa. Es una cuestión también de Norteamérica y Sudamérica. Latinoamérica, gracias a un proceso político muy interesante y muy importante que también se reporta muy mal aquí en Colombia, ha logrado virar geopolíticamente y se relaciona ahora de manera muy cercana con países del sur global. China es en buena parte de Latinoamérica el primer socio de negocios, no Estados Unidos ni Europa. Sudáfrica es parte del grupo del BRICS. Si ese tipo de negociaciones están ocurriendo respecto del oro, del coltán y de las personas, ¿por qué no también respecto de las literaturas? Entre otras cosas, porque eso nos recordaría que en lugares como este, Cartagena, el Caribe, todo lo que escuchamos cuando salimos a la calle, la música, todo lo que leemos cuando leemos a García Márquez o a Frantz Fanon, que es un escritor caribeño, todo eso viene de África.
Oscar, I'm going to let Claudio jump in here now because he's.
Yo quería preguntar por lo que me llama mucho la atención en la intervención, en el vídeo, es el comentario este de que realmente las editoriales anglosajonas en UK o en USA retienen los derechos de africanos y no los usan ni los dejan usar. A ver si es cierto o no, porque no, o sea, yo eso sí que entiendo que sea una queja, que eso sí que tiene que ser una queja importante y algo.
Binyavanga was absolutely right, and he's of a generation of writers who have actually changed that relationship. And so, just to recap, what he was saying, that when he wrote his book, his publishing house would not allow him to retain the African rights. They wanted the Commonwealth of English rights. Now, to some extent, that Commonwealth idea is a nonsense, because it's a vast geographical area that's only united by having been former colonies. Mm-hmm. And so what Binyavanga and his generation have done, and I helped in this process when I was at Random House, is to say that because you do not have the distribution links in African countries, we will not be giving you those rights. Random House, in the end, managed to rewrite their contracts to allow African writers to do this, because a body of them were saying, we know you want us. You know that you want our stories, but you can't have them unless you give us these rights. And with that rewriting, the last 10 years, it's completely changed the way. When those books then are sold in Nigeria, instead of a big distribution warehouse and cocktail parties, you have the same drivers who are taking the Nollywood films will have on their bicycles those books. So you create something completely new. It's a new way of publishing, but it only happens because the writers then have that power. And again, it brings me back to those writers knew that they want to be published in those countries, their own countries, because they know that they have the readers, whereas the publishers in London, and I was one of them, didn't know the readers and didn't trust the readers. And if we're working together and trusting the readers and the potential of that marketplace, then all of these things that we're talking about become a lot more simple, I think.
I'm just going to just open it to the floor now, just because I think it's really important that everybody here feels very included in this discussion, which we hope will continue after this event. There will be a lot of information on the Writers' Centre Norwich website, and we encourage everybody to participate, be it through social media or, in fact, here in this room now. So if there is anybody here with a question, we'd be happy to hear from you.
La pregunta es para el escritor Oscar. Yo quiero que él nos dé un ejemplo concreto de cómo España nos piensa a nosotros. Gracias.
Esa es una pregunta muy justa. El ejemplo concreto es el siguiente. Cuando en Colombia se describe el terremoto político que está teniendo lugar en España, el lenguaje que se utiliza usualmente contiene la palabra populismo. Es muy curioso porque el término proviene de un escritor latinoamericano, en el sentido en que se lo está utilizando en los medios españoles. No sé si ustedes sepan esto, pero el pensador más influyente en este momento en Europa es un argentino cuyo nombre es Ernesto Laclau. Pero cuando la palabra llega a Colombia, llega cargada desde un tono y una connotación completamente peyorativa, que no tiene nada que ver con la manera en que la trabaja el propio Ernesto Laclau, ni sus estudiantes griegos, que ahora son ministros de gabinete, ni los intelectuales que pasaron de la universidad a la arena política en España. Ese es un ejemplo de cómo esa conversación que es circular termina siendo pervertida. Qué interesante sería que pudiésemos darnos a la tarea de trabajar ese tipo de conceptualizaciones que producimos aquí entre nosotros, de manera que esas otras cargas que tienen que ver con miradas y perspectivas geopolíticas no perviertan el significado más interesante, más rico, más útil de esos términos. Ese sería mi ejemplo concreto.
Thank you. We have another question there.
Hi. I would like to address this question to Wainaina, but he's not here. So Ella talked about this also in her answer, and so I will make it in English just because of that. You were saying that you thought editors were really important, which is something that the digital world has still trouble with. But from what he said, and I believe this is something to be really a truthful thing right now, the revolution, it's going to be digital somehow. How do we include editors into that world? Because the mass contents do not only require your abilities to edit the text, but the text is now almost everything. You can scan an image, you can transform a text into something visual, into audio, into everything. Everything is included now in a novel in a are you okay? In a pretty more significant way. I mean, a novel always has been a blending pot, but now it's also a sensorial blending pot. How do editors get into that in order to make those contents available for the readers? How do we put the writers in dialogue with the readers through those editors in this digital world that Wainaina was talking about?
Thank you. That's a really excellent question. And it's a conversation that Binyavanga and I have had a lot of the time, because anybody can publish. You can wake up in the morning and you write your blog and it's out there and it's published. You will find that with the blogs, with the fan fiction, with the writing, that actually has sustained success. It's because it's curated. Not everybody just wants to hear the outpourings of a 13-year-old teenage girl's heart, you know. Sometimes the fashion blogs are fun, but actually when you want content that's valuable, you go for that curated content. And so the challenge is then, how do you create that new publishing model that allows for quick turnover, but also allows for some filtering of the process? The reason that Random House, Penguin and Random House, does become that mafia is because there's a lot of investment put into the selection of text and the editing of text and then the production of text. But when you're dealing with the digital world, those models aren't there. But they're going to have to be there if actually there's going to be the creation of a marketplace and the building of an industry. And I think that actually it's part of the challenge. There's no answer to the question, but I know that for as many writers that are out there are people who want to make books but don't want to write. And it's about training and educating them so that when we find the solution and we're ready to pick up our arms and take part in the revolution, that we have the right equipment to do it. And I think that's my main concern. So,
Ella, thank you. We're almost out of time, but I have a question for Claudio, which goes back to what Binyavanga was talking about. He was saying how very popular mobile phones are across Africa, particularly in East Africa, and how that's really fueling or could fuel a publishing revolution. Is that the case in Latin America, and is that something that Penguin Random House might look at, publishing on that medium through that platform?
Sí, yo eso no estructuralmente creo que puedo decir mejor, Óscar. Lo que sí, si hay la industria, si hay mucho smartphone, lo que sea. Lo que sí que creo fundamentalmente es que lo digital, también se hablaba antes, es el digital, ya sea para leer en un smartphone o para leer en una tablet, salvará buena parte, por ejemplo, de lo que es la literatura más elevada. Por mucho que la industria avance, por mucho que en América Latina o en África lleguen los países mejoren, seguirán habiendo lugares como países o zonas concretas en los que va a ser muy difícil hacer llegar los libros. Los libros van a seguir siendo muy caros. Yo no puedo enviar libros a una zona de Bolivia porque si hago una edición ahí no tengo el suficiente número de lectores y si lo envío llegan allá a $100 y más caro que lo que cuestan. ¿Cuál es la solución a eso? Es una solución muy complicada que todos los editores piensan. La solución en cierta medida puede ser lo digital. Llegará un momento en cuando realmente, como os comentaba antes, todo el mundo disponga de una conexión a internet y un aparato, un device para poder leer los libros en el que por lo menos sabremos que todo el mundo tiene acceso a la cultura.
And finding those solutions is something that we at Writer Centre Norwich will be continuing to do, and we hope that will happen with your help. As I was saying, please do get involved. The conversations are already producing further debate, lots of collaborations, developing projects, and lots of plans for new work. So do visit the website and get involved yourselves. Very much, very many thanks to our panelists, to Binyavanga, who sadly couldn't join us live, but for his excellent provocation at the beginning. To Claudia Lopez de la Madrid, to Ella Wakatama Orfrey, and of course to Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Thank you.
Thank you.